Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Today I am welcoming in studio David Asher, an author of the new book, The Art of Natural Cheesemaking. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much.
I'm so delighted to have you in studio.
Oh, really great to be here in Brooklyn.
So you have come all the way from British Columbia?
That's right.
And how long a visit to New York?
I'm here for about a week.
Great.
This is the final stage of my first international book tour.
Oh. Mm-hmm. And I understand you've been doing a lot of cheesemaking activities?
Yeah, all across the states and Canada. I've been teaching classes and doing demonstrations and book readings on the West Coast in Washington State, California, Wisconsin, Illinois, Ontario, and now here in New York.
Okay. And you had some courses over the weekend?
That's right. I gave a few classes with Slow Food USA at the Crown Finish Caves here in Brooklyn.
And how did those go?
Fantastically.
Oh, great.
Yeah, had a great crowd, and we put on a good show.
Is it the same course over and over, or do you offer different courses during the book tour?
I like to offer a selection of different cheese courses. This one past workshop was a more intensive class. I gave five different sessions on various cheesy topics.
Did anyone take all of them? Could you take all of them?
Yeah, a few people did stay for the entire weekend. Quite a few people came from out of town. A few cheesemakers from the Northeast came out to take the class.
Wow.
And some people even came down from Canada.
Oh, neat. So that must have been exciting.
Yeah, it was great to have.
And you, I presume you signed and sold books?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a small mountain of them.
So have you been to New York before?
My brother used to live in Brooklyn, so I know the city a bit.
When were you last here?
About 10 years ago. It's changed quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. Especially Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
This part you never would have come to 10 years ago.
No, probably not.
So do you have any time for being a tourist while you're here?
Yeah, I got to spend the day walking around Chelsea and Greenwich Village today.
Oh, it's a perfect day.
Mm-hmm.
The weather in New York is perfect today.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go to the book, The Art of Natural Cheesemaking. It came out this year, right?
That's right, just a couple of months ago. It's hot off the press.
And what was your primary motivation in writing this book?
The main reason why I wrote it was to provide a resource for learning how to make cheese a more natural way.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't really any guidebooks out there that teach an organic philosophy in cheesemaking.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the sort of cheesemaking that I practice at home, a very natural approach.
Mm-hmm.
And I teach a lot of cheesemaking courses around Canada and elsewhere. And I wanted to provide a resource for my students to take home after the class so that they can continue on learning on their own after taking a workshop.
And they might not remember all the details.
Exactly. So so now with this resource I've provided, this book, students can remember everything that I teach them and do some more exploring on their own time.
Okay. And who do you think is your basic audience? Would it be people who want to make cheese at home or people who want to start businesses?
Well, the book can appeal to almost everyone, not just small-scale artisan cheesemakers who I feel will be really interested in some of the techniques that I share on making cheese more naturally, but also home hobby cheesemakers, including those who are just starting out. There's some very very approachable introductory cheeses in there,
mm-hmm.
But also for just the cheese eater, anybody interested in knowing how their favorite cheese comes to be.
Mm-hmm.
I've got some interesting insights in how on how different styles of cheese make different style of cheeses that we enjoy came to be.
Okay. Now, did you have to sell the idea to a publisher, or did they come to you?
I did. I went a knocking.
a knocking?
On Chelsea Green, my publisher in Vermont.
And they're a very friendly to food publisher.
Very much so. Very friendly to cheese also,
mm-hmm.
and very friendly to fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
My book kind of bridges those two.
Mm-hmm.
They're my favorite publisher because I'm really into food and farming and cheese. And
mm-hmm.
they published a lot of books on the subject, and I have a lot of their books in my home collection.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite book of theirs, published by my favorite author and mentor, Sandor Katz, is
okay.
Wild Fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very important book in my development as a cheesemaker.
Mm-hmm.
It's really inspired a lot of the philosophy, the natural philosophy of my cheesemaking. And I felt that because they'd published these books, the different books of Sandor, as well as other cheesemaking guidebooks, that they would be interested in this wild fermentation-inspired approach to cheesemaking that I provide.
Mm-hmm. Now, where is Sandor from?
He lives down in Tennessee. He's the father of the fermentation revolution.
Okay. He's self-described, or is that your term?
That's how I refer to him.
Okay.
He's revived the practices of kombucha making and sauerkraut making and sourdough baking all across America.
Okay. I don't know him, but didn't he write the introduction to your
That's
book?
That's right. He wrote the foreword to my book. So I'm really blessed to have his words at the beginning of my book.
So you and he know each other?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. Mm-hmm. That's nice. So you went a-knocking at the publisher's door. Were they pretty receptive right away?
Yeah, very receptive. They were very encouraging and very enthusiastic about the idea. They got back to me really soon
mm-hmm.
After I sent a query and asked me to submit a full proposal.
Mm-hmm.
And after I spent a few months laboring away at
right.
perfecting my proposal.
Right, how long did that take?
It was probably a three-month process.
Right. How many pages is a proposal? Yours?
I mean, every publisher is different. They all ask for different things from prospective authors.
Mm-hmm.
They ask for a couple of chapters, biography, some background material, and they wanted to know what the target audience would be and
mm-hmm.
How my book compared to other books on the subject. So
mm-hmm.
I did my research and wrote a few chapters, and they liked what I had to say and
mm-hmm.
signed me on to write the book about 2 years ago.
Okay. I was going to ask, how long did it take to write the book?
About a year and a half total.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, from starting the proposal, from writing the first chapters of the proposal to having the finished product in hand was about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm. And did most of your time get spent writing the book?
Yeah, either writing the book or making the cheeses that are featured in the photographs
mm-hmm.
of the book.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so planning for the photo shoots.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, milking the
okay.
animals, you know.
making
actually, the cheeses in my own home, yeah.
And, milking the animals?
Yeah,
do you have
exactly.
animals?
I used to. I don't keep any animals anymore. I found it really hard to balance the writing and the
mm-hmm.
traveling and teaching
right.
With the care of the goats that I used to have. So mm-hmm. friends of mine are taking care of them now, and someday I hope to take them back into my home.
Can you use their milk?
I can.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
good. That's good. Now, what parts of the book were the easiest to write?
The ones, the chapters that describe my favorite cheeses, of
okay.
course. So cheeses like the goat cheese section are really fun and easy for me to write. Because
oh, because you knew
yeah,
them
I know,
like,
I know
like
them
the back of your hand.
So
and,
well, exactly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the pages on the philosophy of cheese making were interesting to me, but more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to do a lot more research on traditional practices.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to explore certain methods of cheesemaking in order to learn more about them, ones that
mm-hmm.
I'm not totally familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to refine my methods in some different styles that I hadn't perfected yet in order to be sure that I could, you know, teach clearly in my book how to make these particular styles of cheeses. So
mm-hmm.
some took a little bit more work, yes.
Okay. Now, you said you had to do research. How much research did you do? What did it involve? And did you have any help?
So some of my research involved consulting other cheese-making guidebooks, a few mm-hmm. other guidebooks really, you know, important for helping me develop this book.
Mm-hmm.
I went looking through old texts, like looking at ancient cheese-making practices, like looking at how people used to make rennet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For instance, you know, I've got a recipe in my book on how to produce your own rennet from a calf stomach,
mm-hmm.
But the technique isn't really all that written about in contemporary literature, so I had to go back.
That's one of your first recipes,
that's right.
Is it
yeah,
not?
It may be the first recipe in the book. Well, it's what gets cheese started, right? So I had to go looking at a text from before, you know,
it didn't
from
sound
World
that
War
appetizing,
I, in order to find
I have to admit. But it's not supposed to.
It's not supposed
right,
to.
Right, yeah. Right. So you did research there. Did you have any help? Did you have a research assistant?
I didn't have a research assistant. I did most of the research on my own.
Okay.
On my own. And a lot of the research that I also did involved my own experimentation with milk.
Mm-hmm.
So studying the medium, playing around with the different cheeses I was making, trying out different conditions in the aging environment, using different starter cultures.
Mm-hmm. So that would be kind milks. Of like in-depth recipe checking.
Exactly.
Because the recipes are all cheese, so
yeah.
You were making sure you were recommending a successful recipe.
Yeah, exactly. So looking for the, you know, mm-hmm. the right humidities for making certain styles of cheeses, the right temperatures for getting certain rinds to develop, the right milks for using for making certain cheeses, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you have a background in writing or research or science? What is your particular background?
No, writing is brand new to me.
Mm-hmm.
It was a challenge in that respect. I had mm-hmm. never written anything so substantial in my life before.
It's quite long.
It's quite long. It's,
and the pages
it's almost,
are big.
It's about 300 pages. The pages are big. They're full of writing. Over 100,000 words in there.
Yes.
So that was entirely new to me, and I had to
that
learn
was a
as
surprise
I,
for me
I had to
as
learn
well.
as I went on writing styles and such. My publishers are very helpful and very
mm-hmm.
encouraging in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
So
what is your background?
What did you
do before cheese making?
Cheesemaking has kind of occupied my life for the last 10 years,
mm-hmm.
But it's relatively new in my life. It's not something I studied in school, and it's something mm-hmm. I set out to do mm-hmm. early on. I do have a science background.
Mm-hmm.
I studied environmental engineering,
mm.
so I have a bit of a background in microbiology.
Okay,
but I didn't finish my degree
mm-hmm.
Because I felt a lot more attracted to farming as
mm-hmm.
I was in my studies, and decided I wanted to become a farmer
mm-hmm.
Midway through my degree, and ended up leaving engineering school to pursue my dream of becoming an organic farmer.
Huh. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Is your family from farming?
No.
No.
Farming is not in our blood.
Were they excited about your choice?
No. It was challenging for them to accept my decisions, and
even
to this day, you know,
uh-huh.
even having written the book, it's sometimes a little hard for them to accept.
Oh, but they can be proud their son wrote
no,
a book.
They're coming around.
Okay.
Yeah.
Slowly but surely.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things you talk about early in the book is that weird island in Canada.
Oh, yes, this yeah. off-the-grid island.
Yeah, just as a tangent, can you tell me a little, what's the name of it and what's it about?
So it's called Laskeedy Island, and it's one of the islands in the group of islands where I live on the west coast of British Columbia, Canada.
Oh, so you live on an island, but so, not that island.
Not that island,
okay.
That's right. So
is yours
it's
a bit more...
it's a bit more connected.
Normal?
Yeah, it's a bit more normalized than this one. So this is an island I've traveled to several times in order to put on cheese-making classes, and I've got pretty close with the residents there, and they're all really interested in what I have to share,
mm-hmm.
Because they practice self-sufficiency to an extreme degree over there, because
mm-hmm.
they have very few connections to the outside world. The island is very DIY minded. They have to do everything themselves, because
mm-hmm.
they really have no other way. They have to provide for their community.
Okay, so all food?
Really.
Do they have electricity?
Just about everything they do, they produce at home. They produce their own electricity. There's no public utilities.
Okay.
They have to treat their own waste. They have to deal with all their own garbage.
Wow.
You know,
how
they can't
many
drive
people
cars
live
on or
this?
Off the island.
Oh, you can't.
No,
there's
you can't.
No cars.
There is an occasional barge. They do have cars there. It's hard for any North American to live without love them. And their cars have them there. Many of their cars have been on the island for 40, 50 years because there's no way to get them on or off.
Oh, wow. Yeah. They don't take ferries there ever?
No, the only ferry is an occasional passenger ferry.
Okay, wow. Yeah. So who lives there?
Lots of organic-minded people, folks who want to live with the land.
Are they old hipsters?
There's a lot of old hippies out there, people between, lots of young people, too, that are attracted to that way of life. Mm-hmm. I'm very attracted to that way of life as well.
Mm-hmm.
So
they're a very simpatico community for you.
We got along really well. And they've really supported me in this journey.
Oh, that's
so
neat.
So I decided to write a little bit about them.
Yeah, because I'd never heard of them. It was an interesting little segue in your book. Okay, well, it's time for a break. We'll be back after the break to discuss the contents of the book, David Asher's book, The Art of Natural Cheesemaking.
Farm Families of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board are proud to underwrite Cutting the Curd on heritageradionetwork.org. Wisconsin cheeses have an illustrious heritage of more than 170 years of quality and craftsmanship. During this long and rich history, the art and science of cheesemaking have been captured in time-honored traditions that produce cheese varieties of unsurpassed excellence. Today, Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit www.eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hello, back on Cutting the Curd with David Asher, author of The Art of Natural Cheesemaking. There's so much information in this book. What's great about this gig for me is how much I get to learn and how much more I need to learn. But anyway, let's discuss your philosophy of cheesemaking. You talk about wanting to, quote, re-embrace the community of microorganisms. Can you explain that further?
Here in North America, we're afraid of bacteria, really. We pasteurize, we sterilize, we sanitize just about everything we come in contact with, including ourselves, our bodies.
You include yourself in...
I personally don't.
Oh, but you are from North America.
I'm from North America.
Yes,
and
yes, okay.
I'm surrounded by that, and I question it.
Okay.
In particular, in our cheese making, we're very sanitized and sterilized in our practices here in North America.
Mm-hmm.
That's necessary for a number of reasons on a commercial scale, but on a home scale, I argue that it's not a necessity. That cheese making can be made in less than sterile conditions with good microbes that we cultivate ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that there's a healthy community of microbes out there that can help cheesemakers practice a very safe traditional cheesemaking. I practice in my cheesemaking a method that's dependent upon healthy communities of microorganisms, mm-hmm. rather than the standard practices in cheesemaking, which depend on monocultures of bacteria, individual freeze-dried starter cultures that I use to make certain cheeses. I rely upon the community of microorganisms that's present in raw milk, the beneficial microorganisms that are present in raw milk to make my cheeses happen. And that's something that's is really hard for a lot of people to do because we're really afraid of raw milk.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand how pasteurizing milk decreases the available good and bad bacteria for cheese making. Mm-hmm. But you also have very strong feelings, and you mentioned it, about freeze-dried starter and synthetic rennet. Can you tell me more about that?
Yes.
Because you go on a lot about that in the book.
So cheesemakers in North America all use these freeze-dried starter cultures, these packaged DVI cultures, as they call them.
All of them?
Just about, I'd say probably 99% of cheesemakers in North America use it. Mm-hmm. And not just the industrial cheesemakers, but the vast majority of our artisanal cheesemakers, even small-scale farmstead organic cheesemakers, use these direct vat inoculant cultures rather than keeping their own starter cultures.
So DVI stands for direct vat inoculated.
You got it, Diane.
Okay.
That's right. So these are freeze-dried cultures cheesemakers use. They buy different packages of cultures to use for making different cheeses. For instance, they'll buy a certain culture for making a Chèvre, a certain culture for making a cheddar, a certain culture for making a camembert. And when they make their cheeses, they'll use that starter to make that certain style of cheese. I believe that there's a different way of doing things, that traditional cheesemakers didn't have access to these DVI starter cultures when they made their cheeses, and yet traditional cheesemakers making cheese before they had an understanding of the microbiology and the chemistry involved in the cheesemaking process discovered just about every style of cheese that we know and love today, and were able to cultivate the conditions that led to the development of all these style of cheeses without having to use these freeze-dried, sterilized cultures. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
They rely upon the diversity of microorganisms within raw milk, even though they didn't know it was there, to allow their cheeses to develop their particular qualities, because the community of microorganisms in the raw milk that they work with allowed these different cheese styles to evolve from the same milk, because depending on how the milk was handled as it was transformed into cheese, certain strains of microorganisms within the raw milk came to dominate the development because they were encouraged by the different conditions that were created.
Okay. Is there evidence, though, for negative consequences of using these store-bought, ordered DVI cultures?
I feel there is.
What would that be?
And the main one is that in order to create the conditions that allow these DVI strains of culture to thrive, cheesemakers have to create perfectly sterile conditions in order for them to survive.
Why?
Because these cultures are raised in the laboratory in perfectly sterile conditions. They are single strains of microorganisms that don't really exist in nature on their own.
Okay.
In nature, microorganisms generally exist in communities. And when these individual strains of culture are put into the real world, like in the cheesemaker's vat, they become susceptible to other microorganisms that may come in and ruin the cheese make. And cheesemakers have to take extra precautions to prevent these wild microorganisms from ruining a batch of DVI cheese by pasteurizing and sterilizing.
It seems a little counterintuitive that the carefully created culture would be more susceptible to spoiling by other bacteria than what you're recommending.
That might be just because of the way we understand microorganisms in North America isn't exactly on par with what research shows exists on a microbial level. That it's in fact communities of microorganisms that are much stronger than individual strains.
So you're sort of saying it could be our research and we believe incorrectly.
Yeah, our research has
led us down the wrong path.
That's right. Recent studies on the microbiology of raw milk and raw milk cheeses shows that the community of microorganisms in raw milk that's encouraged by traditional cheesemaking practices may in fact prevent unwanted microorganisms from establishing themselves in the cheese.
Right, and that I have heard before, and many in the cheese community believe that, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, another thing you talk about is organic cheese. I have an innocent, maybe naive, bias against organic cheese, but that's because I can go to the grocery store and see a lot of bad organic cheese.
It's true.
And then there's better non-organic cheese from smaller producers.
That's right.
Where do you, what, when you say organic, what are you referring to?
Well, to be honest with you, I feel in the same way as
you've been in your grocery store is the same.
That I will not necessarily choose a certified organic cheese over a not certified organic cheese, because there's
it doesn't apply to cheese making as well as, let's say, meat.
No, in fact, the organic cheese making, the organic regulations really just apply to the production of milk, mm-hmm. rather than really to the production of the cheeses. There's not very many specific standards for organic in cheese making, and cheesemakers who use practices that are approved by the organic certification may not actually be doing things all that naturally.
Right.
There's many non-certified cheesemakers out there that practice a much more natural, much more traditional cheesemaking than many certified organic producers.
Right. That when you're behind the cheese counter, that's what you often have to explain to people, and they think you're leading them astray.
It can be very confusing for the consumer.
Right. Yeah. Right. So when you say you practice organic cheesemaking, what are you implying?
So what I mean when I say that is that I practice a cheesemaking that's inspired by the principles of organic agriculture, and that cheesemakers should strive for practicing as natural and self-sufficient a cheesemaking as possible. That in organic agriculture, organic agriculture farmers are forbidden from using genetically modified crops. So I feel the same should be true mm-hmm. for cheesemakers. That in organic cheesemaking, that there should be no there should be no genetically modified ingredients in the cheese.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that cheesemakers who practice a sort of organic cheesemaking should keep the cultures of their cheese, just like many certified organic farmers save the seeds of the vegetables that they grow.
Mm-hmm.
Certified organic farmers help to build the soil and improve the microbial community mm-hmm. of their farm mm-hmm. through soil building practices. And I feel that cheesemakers should be
right.
doing the same with their cheeses.
I guess I use the word sustainable rather than organic
mm-hmm.
philosophically.
Yes. I suppose I could use that same term as well.
Okay,
like
now this is another offshoot, and mm-hmm. I don't exactly know if you said this or if I just wondered it. I almost got the feeling that you were saying vegetarians should overlook rennet as meat. Did I make that up?
What I guess I'm saying more has to do with the milk, overlooking the milk as a vegetarian product.
Mm-hmm.
I make the argument in the book about vegetarianism and cheese making around one particular ingredient, which is rennet.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And rennet in cheese making is a coagulating enzyme that helps the curd separate out from the whey.
Right.
And this rennet can come from a lot of different sources.
Right.
Some more vegetarian than others.
Right.
So the traditional rennet enzyme comes from the stomach lining of a young calf. It has to be slaughtered
right.
in order for cheesemakers to gain access to that enzyme.
Right.
But there are rennet.
So that's animal killing.
That's why
vegetarians
don't want to use that rennet enzyme
in
exactly.
their cheese.
But the rennet, the animal rennet replacements, these microbial rennets that are on the marketplace today,
mm-hmm.
Even though they may be labeled as vegetarian rennets, do not necessarily make a vegetarian cheese, because in the production of milk, animals have to be slaughtered.
But that's an extra. I mean that. First of all, milking doesn't kill an animal.
It's true. Milking does not kill an animal. No.
So just because the boys happen to get slaughtered sooner than the girls, that's not the cheese eater's problem or responsibility?
I think as a consumer,
It
is the responsibility of the cheese
eater. But you're for cheese eating.
I am, and I'm not against the eating of animals either.
Me neither.
I find they both go hand in hand.
Okay, but you see how I got confused that you were sort of saying it's not the rennet that's meat or meat killing.
Yes.
It's the
it's the cheese itself, not not necessarily the rennet.
And vegetarians should not stop eating cheese. I don't think.
I think that if they're choosing
terrible.
If they're choosing to consume milk and dairy products, that they should choose to consume cheese that's made with an animal rennet.
Ah, okay.
That it shouldn't be considered a non-vegetarian.
But what about kosher?
That's a great question.
If you can talk a vegetarian into animal rennet, do you want to talk a kosher person into animal rennet?
I try to. I can make a pretty good argument.
Okay.
From the rabbis that I've spoken to mm-hmm. about this subject, and I did do some research for this book on this subject because mm-hmm. I wanted mm-hmm. to be able to address it.
Mm-hmm.
From the rabbis that I spoke to on the subject, their impression, from what they've told me, from what I've understood, mm-hmm. Is that rennet, even though it's an animal product and it's not supposed to be mixed with milk
right.
and cheese making, that would be
right.
unkosher.
Right.
The rennet itself is used in such a small amount that it's not, and the way that it's processed doesn't, like it transforms it into something that's not actually meat. And if you were to use it in mixing with the milk, that it would actually be okay. The problem is that the rennet typically doesn't come from a kosher slaughtered animal.
Oh,
so it can't be used.
Interesting. So if it's a kosher calf.
Yes.
Stomach.
If it's a kosher slaughtered calf, then the rennet from their stomach could be used to make a kosher cheese.
I wonder though if that's a more liberal kosher rabbi who responded in that way.
It may be, but I've heard it from a number of different rabbis.
Interesting.
However, kosher rennet kosher calf rennet is impossible to find. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
exist.
Mm, okay.
But traditionally,
but it could be.
It
could be found.
And these days, it could be made.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nobody making it, as far as I know.
Okay.
And these days, any kosher cheese would be made would have to be made because there's no alternative with a mm-hmm. microbial mm-hmm. Non-animal rennet.
Okay. And it's Rosh Hashanah today.
Yeah.
Happy New Year all our listeners who are celebrating. Anyway, you seem very attached to kefir. Is that how you say it?
I call it kefir.
Kefir.
We call it kefir up in Canada.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that's okay.
Do you think we call it kefir?
Americans generally do call it kefir.
Okay. Did you start out using it, or have you gravitated to it after a while?
Kefir culture may be what got me into cheese making. It's
okay.
one of the things that got me into it. I was keeping a kefir culture before I started cheese making. What inspired my first cheese making approach.
Okay. Can you talk about the arguments for and against using kefir in all cheese making, because that's what you recommend.
So that's what I recommend. That's what I do. I use my kefir culture as a starter culture for making my own cheese. And for those of you that don't know,
it's the first thing you put in.
As opposed to using freeze-dried starter cultures.
Yes.
So I still
do
use the rennet.
Well, but I mean the first step is the starter culture,
and the second step is the rennet. That's right. So kefir culture, for those of you that don't know, is this little culture that you can touch and feel. The culture comes from what's known as the kefir grain, which is this...
there are pictures in the book.
There's some pictures in the book, in case you're wondering. They're these cauliflower-shaped granules that grow in milk and that ferment the milk into kefir. And mm-hmm. people have been keeping these kefir grains for thousands of years. They've been passed down from generation to generation. They were discovered some 6,000 or 7,000 years ago in Central Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And they contain within the grain a diversity of microorganisms, about 60 or 70 different strains, maybe more, of bacteria, fungi, and yeasts.
In the kefir all the time,
pretty stable collection of microorganisms that are actually very similar to the microorganisms that are present in raw milk.
Mm-hmm. So that is a whole community, which is what you talk about wanting
to use and cultivate. Exactly.
Yeah.
And this community of microorganisms in kefir is very strong, and the culture is actually very difficult to contaminate. I've been keeping it for 10 years or so. I've had kefir grains in my hands for about 10 years. Yeah.
You mean going from one to the other to the other?
I feed them every day.
They're relatives.
Exactly.
They are relatives.
Well, they're the same. The same kefir. It just grows over time as you feed it. So I feed it every day. And
it sounds like a horror movie. It's going to take over
It does
your
take
house.
Over your kitchen if you're not careful. This kefir, I feed it every day. It feeds me back kefir, and I use that kefir as a starter culture for making cheese. The culture within it is, in my mind, a perfect starter culture for making cheese because it contains within it the same microorganisms, the same beneficial microorganisms that are present in raw milk.
Mm-hmm. But most of the cheese community believes that your starter culture should be attached to your recipe. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
So you just use your same grains for all your types of cheese.
That's right. So the idea in the cheese-making world is that a certain starter culture should be used for making a certain cheese. So
right.
you use one culture for mozzarella, one for chèvre, one for camembert.
But, and explain that to me a little bit scientifically.
So to make a mozzarella, cheesemakers would choose a certain DVI culture, certain mesophilic starter culture that's used for cheese making at a lower temperature.
Mm-hmm.
For making a hard alpine cheese, they'd use a thermophilic culture, a culture that would be more appropriate for making cheese at a higher temperature.
So are you saying that in the kefir grain, they both exist, so at the temperature it will respond in the right way and the other one won't do anything?
Exactly. So the kefir culture...
You won't have alpine cheese that tastes like mozzarella.
No, you won't. And none of the cheeses will taste like kefir. They'll taste like the raw milk versions of their very own selves.
Have you done a side-by-side tasting?
I do. Yeah. Cheese education is a big part. My own cheese education has been a big part of my research.
Mm-hmm.
So I make certain cheeses with my style, with my kefir culture, and then I compare them side by side with raw milk versions of the same cheese that I pick up from cheese making shops in the city.
I was going to ask you, do you also sometimes make a cheese with a DVI starter and, you know, compare those two? Both made by you.
I don't do that.
Okay, because you don't want the DVI in your house?
I don't want to have to buy DVIs. No reason to purchase them.
Is it economic? I mean, is it cheaper? How much would you spend buying DVIs?
DVI cultures can be quite expensive.
Mm-hmm.
For an average home cheesemaker that wants to make a lot of different styles of cheese, they'll have to buy a lot of different packages of culture.
Mm-hmm.
Each package of culture costs $10 to $20, depending on the variety.
And
they'll only
many?
Last about 6 or so months of cheesemaking. So it can cost a cheesemaker, even a home cheesemaker, you know, a couple of $100 to have a collection of different starter cultures on hand for making the diverse different cheeses at home.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my kefir, which I use as a starter culture, is essentially free.
Mm-hmm. You're just feeding it and making
exactly.
it in
your
kitchen.
I mean, people generally don't pay for them, although you can buy them online. People usually share their kefir grains with one another. It's a gift culture. People are happy to share it with one another because they've often received it as gifts.
And also, you're not giving it all away.
That's right.
You're
keeping
just
some.
Giving a little.
Yeah, you're giving away your excess. That's right. And all you got to do to keep the kefir is feed it milk.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like you're just feeding it milk to keep the kefir alive. When you feed the kefir grain milk, the kefir grain transforms it into kefir, which you can drink. And it's a wonderful probiotic drink that's really delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Got really nice texture. Mm-hmm. Really good for you.
I want to ask you one more question before we end, though there are a million questions that come out of your book. I'll have to ask you later at the bar. Raw milk. Now, in the cheese community, we all lament the increasing challenges to making raw milk cheese. We love it. We want it. And it's attacked left and right. There was something online today about, you know, the FDA is planning their next attack. But you seem to go further. You almost feel like your book is daring people to get their hands on raw milk cheese and use it and drink it, and even if it's illegal. Can you talk about what the laws are in Canada where you live and how you can support encouraging people to do illegal things?
It's a very good question. Up in Canada, we have some of the strictest regulations against raw milk.
You do?
Yeah, you cannot.
What about the French part of Canada?
Even in Quebec, as in the rest of Canada, farmers are not allowed to sell raw milk to the public.
But raw milk cheeses.
Raw milk cheeses. We have the same
Much easier than here, no?
We actually have the same regulations as in the United States.
Oh, okay.
If you're to make 60 days. If you're to make a raw milk cheese, it has to be aged a minimum of 60 days.
Mm-hmm.
However, in Quebec, cheesemakers have lobbied the provincial government to make an exemption for traditional cheeses that they make with raw milk that they age less than 60 days. And so now consumers in Quebec are able to purchase a small number of raw milk cheeses aged less than 60 days. And my, oh my, are they ever delicious.
I'm sure.
And
people
aren't getting sick from them either.
Well, nobody in the cheese world thinks raw milk cheese makes you sick. I mean, you know, in the small cheese world.
Hmm.
Now, the big cheese world is another story.
It's a whole other story. Yeah.
But anyway, so you encourage people to get their hands on raw milk to make your cheeses in the book.
Mm-hmm.
How does people go about doing that? Is it different in different places?
Well, state by state, it's different.
Mm-hmm.
Here in New York State, for example, raw milk sales aren't illegal.
Mm-hmm.
You simply have to go to a farmer to get that raw milk.
Mm-hmm.
You can't purchase raw milk in the grocery store here. However, if you're down in California or Washington State or
mm-hmm.
Oregon or Pennsylvania or a number of other states in the union, raw milk sales are a lot more liberal. People can purchase raw milk in their local grocery stores if there are local producers who are willing to provide it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm encouraging people to support those local producers who are mm-hmm. willing to provide it, to go out and purchase raw milk if it's legal.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also encouraging people to support raw milk farmers who produce raw milk in regions where it's not legal,
mm-hmm.
Because farmers that practice...
Oh, I hear the sirens.
Farmers that practice a raw milk practices, good raw milk practices that make raw milk that's safe to drink, and that involves pasturing. That's a really important tenet of the raw milk movement.
Mm-hmm.
Practice a much more sustainable dairying than your average... industrial dairy that's allowed to sell milk directly to the public.
Mm-hmm.
Or, excuse me, that's allowed to sell milk to the public through their milk marketing boards, for instance,
mm-hmm.
as is the case in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So in Canada, I encourage people to go out and support small-scale, grass-fed dairying operations that may not necessarily be legal because they're practicing a more sustainable dairying than your average industrially produced milk that you can legally buy in
mm-hmm.
the grocery store.
Now, what is the, back to the recipes, if you can't get raw milk, mm-hmm. what milk should you get to make your recipes? And does the kefir starter help add some of the diversity to the even the pasteurized milk?
You got it.
Okay.
You answered the question.
Okay.
But I'll explain a little bit more. You do not need raw milk to make really any of the cheeses in the book, if
mm-hmm.
if you don't want to go out and break the law. And actually, you wouldn't be breaking the law by buying the milk. The farmer would be breaking the law by selling the milk. That's usually
right.
the way the regulation works. You don't actually need to buy unpasteurized milk to make the cheeses in the book, although it does help. It does raw milk does help cheeses
mm-hmm.
evolve more naturally.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can't get raw milk, if it's not legal locally, you can still work with pasteurized milk,
mm-hmm.
so long as it isn't homogenized.
Mm-hmm.
And homogenization is a process that most milk sold in the grocery store goes through. Another bad thing that milk is subjected to that stops that stops its cream from rising to the top. But in the end, it affects the milk in much deeper ways. That
even deeper than pasteurizing.
Perhaps so, because milk that's been homogenized doesn't respond at all to the cheese making process. It's very difficult to work with as
mm-hmm.
as a cheese maker. It'll cause a lot of headaches to the cheese making process and will ruin a lot of cheese if you
mm-hmm.
if you decide to use it. So it's important to go out and source as unprocessed and as fresh a milk as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And generally going to your farmer to purchase that milk,
mm-hmm.
Whether or not that's legal, helps to make the best possible cheese because the fresher and less processed a milk is, the better
right.
a cheese it'll make.
Right, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think everyone would agree with that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, unfortunately we have to end. I want to thank you so much for answering all the questions.
Mm-hmm.
It's been an interview with David Asher, who wrote the Art of Natural Cheesemaking. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And let me also thank Liz Smith, our engineer today. The break music was provided by Odetta Hartman. The theme song to my show is called Cheese by John Burt, and the sponsor has been the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. If you liked what you heard, tell your friends to subscribe to the show on iTunes and check out heritageradionetwork.org. We have a new website coming in a week. And next up, a short clip of The Speakeasy, airing live Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Thank you very much. Signing off for Cutting the Curd.
Well, first of all, fall is my favorite season for cocktails. And it's just, like you said, you know, it's during harvest season. You've got all this beautiful, beautiful produce and different, like everything. Everything's happening during, like, the end of the summer and early fall.
On episode 137 of The Speakeasy, master bartender Aaron Polsky talks to host Damon Bolte on why fall is such a perfect time to make great cocktails.
There are just new ingredients that are available to us in general, you know, and that's great. Like, the accessibility and availability of spices and good quality produce on a wholesale level is awesome. And also the technology to make them work fast. So everybody, well, not everybody, but you and I, know that Dave Arnold pioneered rapid infusion technique with an EC container. And, of course, you can do that with a cryovac or, as I recently discovered, a food saver with a handy food saver Tupperware canister attachment. You can make things work fast. You can experiment quickly. You can weigh things in grams. You can time how long it takes, how long you're putting suction on it. And you can get really good bitters, good infusions. And that's great. In, you know, especially for the fall, because you think of fall, you think of, I mean, all jokes aside, you do think of pumpkin spice. You think of pumpkin pie, and you think of all those warm spices and squash and all that.
Apples,
pears, pumpkin spice.
Yeah.
I think that six years ago, it would have been difficult to find different types of cinnamon, and now you can easily get them.
Whether you know what a rapid infusion machine is, or you're a bartending novice, be sure to listen to The Speakeasy, available on Heritage Radio Network and iTunes.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.